Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 4th of November. All things political coming up this hour on the air with Jill Lawrence. Jill is managing editor for politics for National Journal and has also been a contributor to the Daily Beast, Atlantic.com, PoliticsDaily.com, a national political correspondent for USA Today, and national political writer at the AP. She's written about politics for the Boston Globe, the Atlanta Constitution, the Washington Post magazine, and other publications, and is also a volunteer with something I hope to talk about later in the show, the News Literacy Project, which helps high school students become informed consumers of news. We'll start with some interesting races tomorrow, Election Day, in some parts of the country. Governor's race in Virginia getting a lot of attention. Vice President Biden is campaigning with McAuliffe. Cuccinelli is campaigning today with Senator Marco Rubio and former Representative Ron Paul of Texas. Voters in New York, Bill de Blasio has, as of today, a nearly 40-point lead in the polls in New York City. There is a race, first competitive race in Boston in three decades, and the issue of outside money has been coming into that particular election. So we'll look at that, and we'll look at other issues. Of course, food stamp cuts, benefits to 47 million Americans were cut starting on Friday. We'll talk more about the ongoing questions about the Affordable Care Act and whether or not it's become at all easier for people to sign up and what the true story is about people losing their plans, whether or not there needs to be a bipartisan investigation of the whole act. We'll talk about that. Yet another killing, this one at an airport, Los Angeles, of course, which created all kinds of problems for, of course, the people who were there, the people who were traumatized by this. There was someone killed in the incident, and it kind of disrupts air traffic all over the country and is yet another unnerving killing that took place. We will talk about that and how it's become almost commonplace. We don't even report on it for more than about a day. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jill. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, you can always leave messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Jill.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Sure. That's quite an array of stories.
I know it is. We'll get to all of them and then some. But let's start with politics because it is Election Day. I guess the race that's been getting the most attention is the governor's race in Virginia. Polls showing pretty recently that Terry McAuliffe has a lead. Is this a substantial lead? And what do you make of that race?
Well, the lead is about 6 to 7 points, and it's surprising in one way because usually in these off-year elections, a Republican will win if a Democrat's in the White House. But this race has just been nothing like the usual. First of all, both candidates are completely flawed. Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat, has, kind of a questionable business background, a lot of problems in his business background. He's best known for being a great fundraiser for politicians. And Ken Cuccinelli has been an unapologetic culture warrior with just all kinds of crusades against various social issues supported by Democrats. So, voters really have a choice. It's not a great one, but there's a big contrast between the two of them. And this is in a state where the demographics have been evolving rapidly in the last 10 years.
If you say both of them are rather flawed, does it mean a lot of people won't show up tomorrow?
You see in the polling that many, many, in fact, most of McAuliffe supporters are voting against Cuccinelli. Mm. And I think that he inspires a lot of passions among liberals and moderates. So it may be that there will be some turnout. Also, the McAuliffe campaign is trying to learn from the Obama campaign and kind of turn out people, in the nooks and crannies of the electorate who don't vote that often, that regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that, combined with the tremendous increase in minorities and moderates in the suburbs of Virginia, this is probably going to make it impossible for Cuccinelli to win.
Is it at all a referendum on the popularity for the Tea Party? Is it safe to say that Cuccinelli considers himself a member of the Tea Party, and would this be a vote on that as well?
Well, I think that a lot of Democrats and some Republicans would like to see it as that, because Cuccinelli is definitely in the Ted Cruz mold. You know, he was the first attorney general to sue over Obamacare. He spent part of his attorney general tenure suing a climate scientist at the University of Virginia. These lawsuits didn't go anywhere, but he's, you know, if you're a Cruz Republican, you're in it for the fight. So he carried the torch, and he fought the battle. So, I mean, I think, you know, that he'd like to see it as a referendum on Obamacare. I think others are going to see it broadly as, can this type of candidate win in a nation that's changing? The state is almost a microcosm of some of what's going on nationally. So, you know, the same argument was had in 2012 over what the election taught the Republican Party and the Democrats, for that matter. And Republicans in particular had a whole prescription for how to change and do outreach and expand their base and their appeal, and they haven't done any of it. So, mm-hmm. You know, maybe this will be the election that sets them on that path.
New Jersey, Chris Christie is going to win big, probably. What are your thoughts about what he's thinking about for the presidential run in 2016? Is he?
Well, he's definitely impressed a lot of people as road testing a message for 2016 in this campaign by talking about the work that he's accomplished, the achievements that he's gotten working with Democrats. And that is a completely opposite approach from what's going on in Virginia. So, but of course, the states are different. So it's not quite the model laboratory, but it's pretty close. A lot of people are going to be drawing the contrast and drawing some lessons from what happens. He was actually campaigning with Susana Martinez, the governor of New Mexico, and was asked whether this was a preview of the 2016 ticket, and he didn't say, "Are you kidding?" He said, "I don't know, but I'm glad she's here." So that was kind of a non-denial. But I think it's assumed he's going to run, and many people, including Mitt Romney, think he's the party's best hope. Now, that's, you know, from the long view. There's a lot of specifics, like his temperament, that may come into play and not be as positive.
I was seeing a TV, it was a news show last night, and somebody was interviewed, one of the voters in New Jersey, who said, you know, we love him here. He's a real New Jersey guy, but sometimes his bluntness and directness may not play well in other parts of the country.
Well, I mean, blunt and direct is one thing, but he's confrontational. Mm. And, you know, and he fights with teachers a lot. He fights with a lot of people a lot. Now, for him, the point is not the fight. The point is the fight to get somewhere in the end. So that's a difference. And he does, or he has had, some fairly moderate positions. But one thing that would be really interesting about him in the primaries is I don't think there's any way he can be someone he's not. You know, what you see is what you get. And, you know, you're not going to have somebody like Mitt Romney, who's evolved all over the place on various positions and whose personality was kind of elusive. You know, this guy's going to be up front.
Right. Exactly.
For better or worse, right?
Right, right. The New York mayoral race, Bill de Blasio expected, he's got a 40-point lead today. This is kind of an interesting guy, isn't he? I mean, he really is very, very progressive. Do you think it'll work for New York, or does New York find itself better managed by somebody like Bloomberg?
You know, it's an interesting question. This certainly seems to have been a reaction against Bloomberg and even maybe Giuliani before him. You know, just people who were trying to improve the quality of life in the city for the middle class so they wouldn't leave and there'd be a tax base. And so along comes de Blasio, who is a very interesting guy. He married a black woman who had been a lesbian until she met him. And they have two kids who've kind of become the stars of the campaign, particularly his son, who was in a very well-received ad. So, you know, he's got an interesting background, and he's got a very populist pitch. And it's kind of like, you know, what about the rest? What about the non-1% or 10% or 20%? What about the people who are really struggling and can't afford to live in this city anymore? And so he's been really straight about, you know, I want to tax the rich to pay for preschool, that sort of platform. And I know people are looking at this as possibly a model for Democrats to be unapologetically progressive like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are talking about New York, which
right.
is not exactly a microcosm of America, right?
Right. Yeah.
So I'm not sure, but it is kind of interesting. And, you know, how he governs, you know, he'll have a lot of tests, including how he deals with business and also a lot of union contracts coming up. And will he show backbone? Will he give in? You know, how will he handle finances? It'll be fascinating to watch.
Yeah, it will be. My husband just got back from Boston, and he said that the mayor's race out there is, of course, the talk of the town in Boston. So I looked into it a little bit. I normally wouldn't, but it is an interesting race. It's the first competitive race in 30 years in that city. Two, you know, Irish guys, and one is accusing the other of getting all kinds of outside money, $2.5 million from Labor. I didn't even know Labor had that much money now.
Well, you know, maybe this is the Labor comeback election.
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very close race, unlike, you know, New Jersey and New York. And it's kind of interesting that there are two white guys who are Irish at the top of the field. Both progressive Democrats don't really have that many differences in their positions, and they're both getting outside money. Marty Walsh from Labor and John Connolly from education groups. But Walsh is clearly cleaning up on the money front. And he had been behind, but the last couple of polls show him pulling ahead. So I think it's still within the margin of error. It'll be interesting to see who turns out. It seems like if Labor's in gear with their turnout machine, of course, teachers have a turnout machine, too.
Yes, they do.
We'll see.
Yeah. Are there other races going on in the country that we should be aware of, Jill?
Those are the big four. Virginia's really the marquee race this year.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to, I wanted to do those first because I figured as soon as I mentioned the Affordable Care Act, our phone calls will go in that direction, although perhaps people will surprise us and they'll have some interest in some of those races. Is it at all easier to get on this darn website now?
I think it's getting easier. I wouldn't be surprised if people were also not flooding it at the moment. It's, you know, they say they're making fixes day by day, hour by hour. I mean, I think, you know, from my own perspective of trying to use it, it's, once you get on it, it's very complicated comparing and contrasting all these plans and seeing who's in the network and comparing the deductibles and the copays and this and that. I mean, you really need to focus. And it's because this is not a normal product, you know what I mean?
Right.
I think a lot of people are going to end up using the phone or calling navigators, you know. It's just not an easy sign up. But I think it's going to be easier and easier. Now, they haven't made any promises for ease until November 30th.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people would be wise to wait at least a couple more weeks before they start getting on it and trying to buy something.
And now there's all this, maybe it's also an indication that this hasn't been explained very well, but there's all of this battling going on, a lot of people saying I lost my health care coverage, you know, the other thing that I have to get is much more expensive, I'm unhappy, other reports are saying that's a minuscule number of people, and their plans have to be a little more expensive to make coverage available to the people who are sicker in this country. I mean, I guess, what would you expect? It was going to, the political differences over this were going to continue and are going to continue.
Well, I think, you know, part of it was that the president's formulation was very misleading. You know, if you like your health care, you can keep it. I mean, when has that ever been true, even for people who have it through their employer? You know, they switch plans from year to year.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they stay with the same insurer, the plans change or the doctor networks changes. So, you know, it's always a very fluid market. But I think now what you're seeing is that people in the individual market are experiencing what people in employer-based plans don't really see firsthand, which is that, you know, if you're young and healthy, you're probably, you know, you're paying more to subsidize the people you work with who aren't so young and healthy, but you're getting an employer contribution which cushions it, and, you know, you're just not kind of as in touch with the fact that maybe you used to be paying less and now you're paying more. So I think that's what's going on. I mean, this is supposed to be a pool with lots of people in it to, you know, level the playing field on costs. And And also, I suppose if these people could think ahead, if they wanted to, you know, to when they're 30, 40 years older and are going to need care. So it's, you know, it's a very difficult transition period that I don't think anyone was really prepared for in the individual market. And then there's also the aspect that Talking Points memo pointed out today, which is that insurance companies, when they're telling people that their individual policies are being canceled because they don't meet standards of the Affordable Care Act, they're not always saying you might be able to go on the exchange and find a cheaper plan. They're just saying here's a plan that's comparable and here's how much it's going to cost.
Oh, that's interesting. Trying to keep the money in their pockets, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And even when they are offering things on the exchange that are similar but cheaper on the exchange. So it's, you know, there's some scrutiny going on now of these letters that are going out.
Jill Lawrence is our guest for All Things Political. She's managing editor for politics for the National Journal. We're talking about some of the political races, which may be of interest to some of you tomorrow in Virginia and Boston and New York and New Jersey. What do you think about any of those? Are they races that are indicative of where things will be going in terms of support for the Tea Party, in terms of roadshow for Governor Christie, in terms of are people just way out there when they're saying maybe the Democratic Party really is best served by people like Bill de Blasio? What do you think? We certainly welcome your phone calls and, of course, the Affordable Care Act. There was another shooting, a horrendous shooting, this one at the Los Angeles airport. We'll talk a bit about that. And food stamp cuts, which went into effect on Friday and will affect all kinds of Americans because the SNAP benefits are administered by the Department of Agriculture and they're authorized in this omnibus farm bill that covers all agricultural programs, including subsidies, and because Congress isn't doing much of anything, they're not doing much about this either. So what do you think about all of these issues? Or bring up other ones. We certainly welcome your calls. Here's how you reach us for All Things Political, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you now. Email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to reach us that way, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All Things Political this hour. Jill Lawrence is our guest, contributing editor at the National Journal, and we'll start our calls with Jean in Madison. Hi, Jean.
Yes. I have a question. Why is it there is very little talk of two programs which are bigger than NAFTA, and NAFTA certainly engendered talk, namely the Trans-Pacific Partnership and then the Transatlantic Investment Partnership? You hear nothing on Wisconsin Public Radio and other media about issues which somebody called them NAFTA on steroids. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jean.
By NAFTA on steroids, we're talking about internationalist economic agreements that perhaps the caller feels are taking jobs out of America.
I would assume that's what his thoughts are, yes.
I plead guilty to not having covered those two agreements. I think, you know, there's been a lot of looking back at NAFTA and wondering if and what it accomplished, but the global economy is a fait accompli. You know, there's no going back from it. So I think what we need to do is learn to live with it and adapt our agreements to benefit us as best we can.
And, Jean, I think you're right. We have not covered that. We've certainly covered the aftermath of NAFTA, but we will look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership and do a show on that. It has been covered not very extensively. Thanks for your call. Reed in Clintonville. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
Say, just two quick things. The first, concerning our ersatz governor, Scotty Walker, if he is campaigning for Ken Cuccinelli and Ken Cuccinelli loses, which it appears he will, is this going to affect Scotty's credibility and in his attempt to run for president, which I doubt if he will ever be? Secondly, many of the Tea Public and members of Congress, at least 15 of them, I believe, who have voted to cut food stamp benefits have themselves been beneficiaries of millions of dollars of farm subsidies. So they're voting for their own subsidies at the same time as voting to cut food stamps for the most needy. And I'll hang up here and listen to any comments.
All right, Reed, thanks for the call.
You.
Take them in whatever order, Jill.
Well, in terms of your governor, I think if Governor Walker had not gone to campaign for Ken Cuccinelli, that would have hurt more in a Republican primary process than actually going, regardless of whether he wins or loses. And, I mean, whether he wins or loses, that'll hurt him with moderates because Ken Cuccinelli is not a moderate. That being said, a lot of luminaries in the Republican Party have come in to try to help Cuccinelli, including Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. And, you know, it's just a thing to do. And the race has been close enough that it hasn't always seemed like a lost cause like the Democrat in New Jersey. So, yeah, I don't think it's going to affect his credibility. I think it'll actually do him good in a presidential. Now, it might hurt in the gubernatorial because it doesn't make him seem awfully moderate. But in terms of a presidential primary, yeah, that's kind of a T you got to cross. Now, in terms of the people in Congress who voted to cut food stamps while getting farm subsidies, you know, that's a political ad that writes itself, and it's hypocrisy that some Republicans are very worried about, or the appearance of hypocrisy. They don't seem to see the conflict between cutting benefits for food stamp recipients and keeping benefits for themselves. And I think, you know, there's a feeling among some that there really is a lot of cheating and waste, fraud, and abuse in the food stamp program. And so, you know, that these cuts are justified, and also that it expanded so tremendously during the recession that now that the economy is somewhat recovering, that it's time to pull it back. So, I mean, you know, there are reasons for what they're doing, but you're right, it doesn't look good.
Mm-hmm. Could we talk just a little bit before we go back to phones about the strength of the Tea Party? We kept hearing after the government shutdown that Americans were blaming the Republicans for this, and specifically the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, and watch out, Tea Party, you're on the wane. Are they, or are they changing? Are the issues changing? And will the Tea Party be very, very important in the midterm elections?
Well, you know, in August, I talked to a whole bunch of business lobbyists, including one who used to be the political director at the Chamber of Commerce and helped elect a lot of these Tea Party people in 2010. And they were all kind of either bemused or beside themselves about what was happening on the Hill. And that has now kind of evolved into some of these groups spending money to challenge Tea Party Republicans in primaries with, you know, putting their money behind business-friendly candidates who don't want to default on the debt or shut down the government and who favor more conventional means of legislating. So that's going to be very interesting to watch. There's some House challenges going on for next year. And then there's several very mainstream Republicans who are being challenged in Senate primaries, including Lamar Alexander, who, you know, the first instinct in 2010 was to move to the right, as we saw, say, Senator John McCain do, to fight off a Tea Party challenge.
Right.
And I think Orrin Hatch did the same thing. But now we have Lamar Alexander fighting back, saying that's not the way to do business. And, you know, and he's not apologizing. I mean, this is a guy who left the leadership in the Senate because he wanted to be able to work across party lines, and he felt he didn't have any flexibility as part of the leadership. So, you know, he's who he is, and he has been the governor, and he has been the head of the university system there. He's very well established, and we'll see what becomes of him by taking this tactic. But I do think that, you know, the honeymoon is over between the business and the establishment part of the GOP and the Tea Party.
And is there enough money to support people like Lamar Alexander, or is the big money still Koch brothers money, et cetera, behind very conservative candidates? And there's more of that money.
Well, you know, the Chamber of Commerce is not poor, and it's got CEOs of its own who could, you know, contribute on their own or through outside committees. I think, you know, they have to decide which way they want to see Congress go, and they have to decide what's it worth to them to try to nip this in the bud, or to try to, you know, in the Senate races, keep people who they feel are responsible legislators. And it'll be a test of establishment power But I do think that we're seeing the Tea Party shrink and shrink in terms of its numbers. And, you know, nationally, they're at a low ebb in popularity and in terms of who identifies with them. So, you know, I don't see a situation this year, for instance, like we had in Delaware in 2010, where Christine O'Donnell defeated Michael Castle in that Republican Senate primary. I don't know that a Sharon Angle would win a Republican Senate primary at this point.
Jill Lawrence is our guest. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network, and we're talking about a number of issues, the strength of the Tea Party, whether moderate Republicans will stand a better chance, some of the races tomorrow, the Affordable Care Act, food stamp cuts. Those are just a few of the issues we've discussed, and your calls and thoughts are welcome. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Tom in Jackson, hi.
Hello, Kathleen, and your very special guest. I'm calling because I would say this. I feel betrayed. I've voted Republican for about 90% of my life, but now that's changed. And I think what's happened is that the extremely rich, radical, right-wing Republicans, which is a small amount, most Republicans are good, clear-thinking, well-meaning people, but these extremely powerful, wealthy people, since especially 2010 with the Supreme Court decision, have decided to have things their way, and that means ruining labor, ruining unions, ruining the Democratic Party, and they want to bring things back to even the laws back to the 20s or teens when the working people had no rights. And, you know, they talk about, well, business friendly. Well, how much more friendly can they be? I mean, the tax rate is the lowest it's been since, like World War One, and, you know, communities give them millions and millions of dollars just to move there, and you don't have to pay taxes for 10 or 20 years. The wages that they pay people are so low. One last thing is I'd heard last week on actually an earlier show that the three heirs to the Walmart fortune are worth $140 billion, and yet the people who work for their stores are on government assistance, food stamps, rent assistance, electrical, gas. I mean, it's something really is wrong, and I blame the extremely wealthy and powerful for taking over the regular Republican Party, which I view to be, you know, at least they say they're somewhat moral, but I feel like I've been scammed.
Jill, are you there? No, we lost Jill. We need to reconnect that. I think she heard most of what Jill said, but I won't reiterate all of it. Just he feels like he's been had, Tom says. And we're welcoming your calls on all things political, whatever you would like to discuss. 800-486-8655. What do you think about what Tom had to say? Do you feel that the center part of the Republican Party has been ignored and it's taken over by a more conservative wing, and it's not good, and it's made people leave the Republican Party? Or do you sense that Jill was starting to outline before Tom's call that things are starting to shift and the Tea Party simply is not enjoying the kind of support that it had, and perhaps the Republican Party will be seeing some substantial change? We welcome your thoughts on that. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. We're just trying to reconnect with Jill Lawrence, who is our guest, contributing editor at the National Journal. I don't know how much of that caller you heard, Jill, but it's a guy who voted Republican 90% of his life, and he's had it. He's feel like he's been had by a very conservative Tea Party wing, people who are making a whole lot of money and not concerned about moderation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we can look to Citizens United for the answer to what he's feeling, because there are some people who've really been able to influence the course of elections, including keeping presidential candidates alive long after they might have dropped out, simply by putting in, you know, $2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 million into a committee to support them. So there is a disconnect, although the Tea Party is a pretty grassroots enterprise in some parts of it. So, you know, he is talking, I think, under the influence of living in Wisconsin, where there was at the beginning of the Scott Walker term the big campaign against collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that probably is more salient to people who live in your state, but it's been a theme of Republican campaigns. I'm not sure about Tea Party campaigns, but conservative Republican campaigns. So I guess he's now saying he's voting Democratic.
He didn't really say. I would assume that perhaps he is, unless, you know, he has a choice of a moderate Republican. What he was saying led me to believe that he doesn't vote for conservative Republicans.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, the interesting choices would include somebody like Rand Paul, who's, you know, a libertarian mm-hmm. Republican, and he's fairly populist, at least in his style and in some of his policies, and he has a very interesting way of talking about some of the issues, for instance, charter schools and helping people up the ladder. So, I mean, there may be choices that your caller hasn't considered yet that come up in the course of the next couple of years.
Nate in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, thanks. I was hoping you would be able to provide some background on Chris Christie and maybe either the way he's chosen to stay the same or changed, and also on some issues in specific abortion, education, and global warming. And one of the reasons I'd love to hear those issues in specific, and also ways he's either tried to balance governing and running for re-election in a blue state and yet wanting to run in a Republican presidential primary.
Well, what you've zeroed in on is the place where Chris Christie is going to have a lot of delicate balancing to do in a Republican primary process, because he's, you know, he has said that he thinks global warming is real and partly man-made. This is controversial in the GOP. He's kind of well along on in terms of unions. He's been very, very critical of teachers' unions in his state, and that would play well in a Republican primary. He's vetoed a same-sex marriage bill, and he's against same-sex marriage. He pulled out of a court fight when it looked hopeless, and I think he just decided, you know, instead of going to the mat the way, say, Ken Cuccinelli would have done, that this was just something he couldn't change, and he was going to just kind of, you know, get out before there were diminishing returns. So he's done some gun control in his state, which is interesting. You know, he's very pro-business, which is another thing Republicans really like about him. So he's tried to cut taxes. He has cut taxes. He's tried to reduce spending. He canceled a big new tunnel to New York that would have cost a lot of money. And he's very anti-abortion. So he has a mix of positions.
Mm-hmm. I know it was revealed, I think, in that new book that one of the reasons that Romney shied away from putting him as VP on the ticket were health concerns about Christie. I know he had that surgery. Has it worked for him? Does he appear to be losing weight and a lot more vigorous? And is that an issue when people consider the presidency, considered how much, you know, we watch TV, et cetera?
Well, I think it is an issue, and it was certainly an issue in the vice presidential vetting. And he did have the surgery, and he has lost weight. He looks much thinner.
Does he?
Now, he was vigorous before, and he continues to be. So I think that he probably could pass the health test at this point that most voters, you know, would apply. He doesn't get out there and wheeze or anything. He has asthma, but it seems to be under control. So and his energy level seems to be high. So I think, you know, that's going to be a non-issue. Now, that book had other issues in it from his past mm-hmm. that he hadn't. You know, he says they've been litigated, but they would obviously be re-litigated if he ran for president, having to do with various contract issues and conflicts of interest and that sort of thing. So we'll have to see.
We had another gun incident at a airport. You can take an assault rifle somehow and get it into an airport. And it makes you wonder. You look at Congress to do something just to make it a safer country. These incidents have been happening just about once a week. Somebody's killing a teacher, or they're opening fire at an airport, and we've got an anniversary coming up of the horrendous Newtown shootings, and yet nothing happens on this issue. Absolutely nothing. It leads one to believe that maybe nothing ever will, Jill.
Well, I don't know if we should say that. I just, I don't know what it will take to get even sort of minimal changes in the laws. But they came pretty close last time. And I'm not sure that the president has given up on this yet. There's a lot of other things going on. There always are. But, there may be yet a bipartisan consensus to move on a few issues related to guns. And, there's an interesting question of whether people like Michael Bloomberg are helping or hurting when they put massive amounts of money into races to try to elect people who, agree with them on gun control. But I don't think there's any debate about somebody like Gabby Giffords and her husband, Mark Kelly, the former astronaut. I think that now there's some avenues for advocates to go through. And the Brady campaign, these victims who form
yes.
these groups, that may be more effective in the long run than people who have a lot of money and are really passionate.
Jill Lawrence, our guest, contributing editor at National Journal. We're doing All Things Political, which we always do Mondays at 1 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jill Lawrence, managing editor for politics for the National Journal. Our phone lines have been busy. There are some lines open for you right now. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Evan in Oconomowoc. Hi.
Hey there. I just wanted to touch really quickly first on the issue of Chris Christie's health. If we can get Dick Cheney into the vice presidency twice, I don't know that Chris Christie's health is going to be too much of a hindrance for him. But the point I really wanted to make was going back to a couple callers ago about the influence the Tea Party has had on not only the already elected Republicans, but the potential candidates. The thing that's been holding up the government for so long has been this lack of compromise. And I think that the nature of the Tea Party is this no compromise, we're going to have it our way. And it just seems so counterproductive. And it seems to be changing the way that the candidates have to represent themselves that may or may not be true to their own personal beliefs just to try and cater to this one specific group. And I think that it's a lot easier for the Tea Party to go about campaigning against a candidate on the small issues that they seem to hold rather than looking at the big picture of whether or not they overall represent the Republican Party and are going to be a substantial candidate and able to win the election. It seems so specific on the issues that it's just really souring the way that we get candidates in there. And I identify a lot with the last caller in that I typically would vote Republican, but I find myself looking more and more at the Democratic candidates just simply because they don't seem to have the influence of this far left or far right group that's funding a lot of the issues. So That's my comment, and I'll take my response off.
Thanks, Evan. Thank you. Jill.
Well, Evan has gotten to the core dilemma of the Republican Party because there's, it's the people who are looking nationally and how to win the White House, and then there are people who are looking at their districts, and they don't have to worry about a Democratic challenge. What they have to worry about is a conservative challenge. And in fact, today, there's two issues coming to a head just today that are a test of this. One is a vote in the Senate on the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which mm-hmm. would ban discrimination against gays, lesbians, and transgender people in the workplace. They can still be fired for sexual orientation. And then there was also an op-ed in USA Today by Bob Menendez and John McCain, bipartisan, urging the Senate to ratify the Disabilities Treaty. It's a UN treaty, and Bob Dole was on the floor in a wheelchair the last time this came up and trying to urge his colleagues to support it, and it failed. So they're going to take another stab at it. But these are two ways that Republicans could try to reach out, and I think some of them will. There are enough of them in the Senate that will get this ENDA bill pass the filibuster. But it's, you know, the way the party is kind of contracting to fit the constituencies of the people in the most conservative districts is not a recipe for a national victory. It's not even a recipe I think we're going to see tomorrow for a victory in Virginia.
Hmm, interesting. Thanks, Carl. Thanks, whoever called last. Carl is next.
Evan.
I'm sorry. Evan, thank you, Jill. I appreciate it.
I'm good taking notes.
Good for you. I should have been. Yeah, Carl in Madison. Hi.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I think, you know, in the old days, we all used to listen to Walter Cronkite and draw our own opinions and make our way forward as a people, some of us more conservative and some of us more liberal. But now, as the news media has become more and more these boutiques where you can go and listen only to your people and have only your perspective heard, I feel it breeds a kind of fundamentalism that is really antithetical to the idea of democracy. That democracy can support so many different kinds of ideas and perspectives and ways of life, but it really cannot support a my way or the highway fundamentalism that shuts down or denies or simply will not work with other ideas. It just goes against the idea of a representative democracy to have fundamentalists of any stripe believe that they can just man the helm and take control of it and steer it wherever they want to go.
Well, I think that's an important point, Carl. Jill?
Oh, I agree. It's very important. And I mean, I think that this has to start in school. You know, it has to start with kids, and particularly in high school and college, you know, with debates and discussions where all sides of view, all points of view are discussed and respected, and, mm-hmm. you know, with sort of a fact-based approach to issues, and also, you know, study of the Constitution and how it was created and the compromises that were needed to create a huge compromises, huge, nothing compared to what we're seeing, you know, now that we might need to, say, fix a few aspects of Obamacare. So, I mean, that, you know, that's a starting point. And I agree that the media doesn't help a lot of times. But, you know, we have what we have. And I think that one thing is I think that our elected representatives shouldn't be so scared of losing. If you talk to people who've lost over votes, whether it's TARP or, you know, the Clinton budget way back in 1993, they don't regret it. You know, if they voted for Obamacare, if that's what they believe, they say they don't regret it. And they obviously, you know, felt it was worth the risk at the time. So, I mean, maybe more of that has to be present on Capitol Hill in Washington.
Thank you, Carl. Some lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation with Jill, 800-486-8655. This might be a good time for us because I wanted to talk to you about this news literacy project that you're working with, helping high school students become better informed consumers of news. A couple questions just to start with. Are there a lot of high school students, Jill, do you think, who follow the news? And if they do, they follow it in a wildly different way than the way I followed news in high school.
Well, that's true, and I don't want to misrepresent this. I haven't done this for a couple of years, but I did do several high school classes, and, you know, these were kids who kind of were self-selected in that they lived in suburban Washington, and they were taking, I think it was an AP section of history, but in these classes, they were certainly following news. They were doing it on their mobile devices. And they were doing it possibly through Twitter, or they were going to websites. They were doing it in a much more fragmented way than we would have done it at their age. You know, they don't sit down in front of a TV set and watch the news for half an hour. And they don't read the whole newspaper in the morning. But they do get what's going on. They also do things like they watch Jon Stewart
right,
and Stephen Colbert. So they get,
right.
you know, kind of a strange take on the news. But they are aware of what's going on. And what was the second half of your question?
Well, I guess the second part of it is how you get them to be wise consumers of news. What should, and not just high school students, but what should we all be looking at? Because so much of it reinforces what our natural inclinations are.
Right. Well, I mean, the first thing that you have to talk to the kids about is the suffixes on the websites. You know, if it's .gov or .edu, that's a good sign. Even Wikipedia is wrong sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you can't trust everything you read. And there are ways of checking things out. And there are, if you go to the State Department site or the FBI site or you're going to find factual information. And so you have to kind of talk with them about trustworthy sources and also about, how to evaluate the types of things you might hear on Fox or MSNBC.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email that's come in from Marianne, a healthcare professional. The insurance companies, back to Affordable Care Act, are once again ready to score big, waiting for the ACA to begin so they can weed through policyholders who have become higher in risk, offer new policies with substantially higher premiums to keep their 20% plus profits, and then make it appear it is the ACA's fault.
That will probably only work if none of these people go to the exchanges. I think that's, something that the administration and states that are trying to be constructive about this really need to point out, mm-hmm. that there is more competition on the exchanges. There is also the possibility of subsidies, and chances are, before you sign up, re-up with your insurance company at a much higher rate, you should see what's out there. I know there are trade-offs. It's not a perfect system. A lot of people are finding that their doctors are not on the cheaper plans. It's a huge dislocation. There's no question about it. But it's actually, it's millions of people, but it's a very small fraction of people with insurance.
Yeah. And as you said, it's very complicated, and it's too bad it has to be so darn complicated, because trying to maneuver your way through all of that can drive you crazy, right?
Right. Obviously the simplest thing is single payer.
Yeah.
If you go on Medicare, you can go to any doctor you want, and you don't deal with an insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
But that's never been on the table in any of the discussions about health reform in the United States.
Yeah. Dave in Richland Center, our next caller. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Dave.
Hi. Hey, I have a question and a comment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a registered gun owner, you look at what's happening in the world these days, and you look mostly, if we look, within our borders here, and we see what happened to Gabby Giffords, which was absolutely horrible,
mm-hmm.
It makes me very frustrated. But then I personally know individuals and people, families, that lived through Hurricane Katrina, and they built their homes and their lives around where they lived, and they owned semi-automatic rifles because they knew people were going to come for what they had. And these people get demonized. And what we see these days, and I see as far as public education goes, there's not a lot of education as to what happened before guns and just how horrible some of the ways people were treated and or handled issues before firearms happened to come 350 years ago. And I had run into a public school teacher, not from my area, and I had just run into a conversation and reminded her that Alfred Nobel, who is the Nobel Peace Prize, is the one, the Peace Prize is named after him, and he's the inventor of what we know as modern-day gunpowder. And this woman just went off on me, just lashed out.
Well, my question, Dave, is how do we as a society make sure that people aren't walking into airports, with assault weapons and killing people? I mean, what do we do about that? It's just unnerving.
Oh, my word. It makes me I drive a truck for a living, and I am, on some levels, I do get out of state.
Right.
And you do end up in some unsavory areas. And believe me, I understand both ends of the argument. And
mm-hmm.
I understand them very thoroughly.
Okay, we're about out of time. This is such a hard issue. Talk about health care. This is another one that just seems to be so hard for us to take on in any kind of civilized fashion. I mean, I'm not accusing you, Dave. You were civilized about this. But, boy, do we have wildly different ideas, Jill, in this country.
Oh, we do. And I think, in the case of Katrina, it'd be great if the public authorities could have made those people feel protected so they didn't feel they needed to have their own semi-automatics. It's just a question of, weighing the rights and responsibilities and the regulations.
Yeah. Thank you, Jill, very much
Thank
for being
you,
with us. Thank you. We'll talk again soon. I hope Jill Lawrence, our guest, managing editor for politics for the National Journal. She's also worked as national political writer at the AP, political correspondent for USA Today, and has written for the Atlanta Constitution, Washington Post magazine, the Boston Globe. The list goes on. We thank her very much for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this program. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Stay with us. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we're going to be talking with a actor, very, very well-known, accomplished actor who's done some marvelous work in depicting Medal of Honor recipients. This is the Ideas Network.